We are joined here live in the KODX studios by Maria Tomczyk, local writer and activist, here to give us a wrap-up of this past week's news. Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
So, no Jav. We're back to no Jav for a while.
Yeah, it's going to be at least a couple weeks. He's in the hospital. He's getting ready for some surgery. We're hoping that the surgery will help him out, in particular, help his nerves and help his blood pressure. And then, of course, after the surgery's done, he'll need a little bit of rehab time. So we're expecting 2 to 3 weeks at least.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. We'll keep people posted on developments on
how that goes. Yeah.
Always, Facebook is a good tool if you use that follow the intimate details.
If you friended him, yeah, he posts regularly on Facebook. He apparently likes to sit in his hospital bed with his laptop on his lap.
Yeah.
Sounds a little familiar to me. I'm kind of like that too.
Uh-huh. When you're in the hospital.
No, I'm not in the hospital very often, but I don't like
to get too... But you have a hospital bed at home.
I don't like to get too far from a keyboard, let's say.
Okay. I think we've all experienced that if you walk down a sidewalk these days.
I don't have a problem with leaving the cell phone at home. It's just when I have spare time, I tend to like to spend it in front of a large monitor rather than a little one.
Okay.
Yeah.
All right.
So let's talk about this week's news.
All right. Speaking of monitors, and local judge weighing in on the DOJ.
Yeah. The judge who's overseeing police reform in the city of Seattle, Judge Robart, released his written order this week. On Tuesday, he issued an order on the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, ordering the city, the Department of Justice, the Community Police Commission, and the court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bob, to come up with a working plan by July 15th to fix the contract. Last week, he had said that he was rejecting the portion of the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract that covers disciplinary actions when an officer is accused of and or found guilty of using excessive force against a suspect. Last week, Robart had rejected that contract, and it wasn't clear to some of the members of the city council, like Lorena Gonzalez, who chairs the committee that oversees the police and public safety. It wasn't clear to the mayor what the judge was actually requiring the city to do, but it appears that now he's saying, look, I'm not going to tell you, you have to reopen the negotiations on the contract. Instead, he's saying that they do have to sit down with the Community Police Commission, with the Department of Justice, and with the court-appointed monitor, Merrick Bob, and come up with a plan. And if that means reopening the negotiations on the contract, then so be it. He also extended federal oversight for as long as it will take for the city to get the contract amended. Federal oversight was set to end by January 2020, the two-year period in which he was monitoring whether or not the city was actually adhering to the new police reform laws that the city council passed last year. Now, he's said that he's willing to extend that. He's going to extend that until they come up with a better deal in terms of the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract. Now, Robart also said that his decision was not based solely on the case of Officer Adley Shepard, who was fired for punching a handcuffed woman in the back of his patrol car. Shepard appealed his case to an outside arbitrator who ruled that the chief of police should reinstate him with back pay. Essentially, the outside arbitrator overturned the decision of the chief of police to fire Shepard. Judge Robart had said last week that he was troubled by that, but this week he cited two other cases in which officers were fired for excessive use of force against people of color, one of whom was also handcuffed. In those cases, too, an outside arbitrator ruled to reinstate those officers with back pay, essentially overturning the chief of police's decision. So it was not just a one-off thing, as the city had been arguing, as the city and the Department of Justice had been arguing that, this case of Officer Adley Shepard, that was an exception. You know, other officers won't be able to do that. Well, clearly other officers have been able to do that. So that points to a weakness in the system. Meanwhile, Seattle's sister police agency, the King County Sheriff's Office, was the focus of a letter written by Mothers for Police Accountability this week. They filed a complaint against the department for excessive use of force because of an incident on May 15th when a King County Sheriff's Major, Brian Howard, tased a naked African-American woman who appeared to be in the middle of either a psychotic episode or a drug-induced hallucination or perhaps a combination of both. Now, it's pretty hard to argue that a naked woman is a danger to anyone since she's not obviously armed. She was in pretty obvious distress, though. And the complaint says that because she was a woman of color, she was treated differently than a white woman in the same situation would have been. And I think that's pretty clear. The letter says that Major Howard should have called a female deputy and a crisis response team instead of trying to subdue her himself. He claims that there wasn't time because she was darting in and out of traffic. So, of course, to prevent her from getting hit by a car, he hit her with his taser instead. And I should point out that small women can be killed by tasers, which are powerful enough to knock down a large man. And there have been incidences in the past where people who have an underlying health condition, one that perhaps was not previously diagnosed, have been killed when tasers were used on them. In addition, when a person is under the influence of drugs, drugs that you don't know what is in their system, using a taser on them can cause a critical health event. So that in itself endangered her. Now, the King County Sheriff's Office has been the center of a lot of use of force complaints in the past. It is long past time for them to undergo a public review of some kind. Now, the Trump Department of Justice is not going to do it. We know that for sure. Dow Constantine, however, is the King County executive, and he could appoint an outside panel to take a look at these problems in the King County Sheriff's Office. And I think some pressure should be put on him to do so.
All right. Moving on, the navigation team lost one of its team members this week.
Yeah, a pretty critical team member. Reach, R-E-A-C-H, is said this week that it's no longer actively working with the navigation team on all of their encampment sweeps. Erica Barnett reported this on her blog, The Sea is for Crank, that the nonprofit social service group, Reach, is no longer working alongside the navigation team during all of its encampment sweeps. Reach is the group that usually contacts residents of unauthorized tent encampments and makes offers of shelter and services to help get them off the street and get their issues treated in that 72-hour window before the navigation team sweeps the camp. Typically, the navigation team is supposed to post notices of an impending camp and sweepment within 72 hours at least 72 hours before they come in and dismantle the encampment. And in that 72-hour window, Reach would then step in with their outreach coordinators to contact all of the members of the camp, as many members of the camp as they can, and make offers of shelter and of services to them. But this week, Reach's co-director, Chloe Gale, said that the navigation team is no longer providing that 72-hour window, except in very rare cases. Instead, they're focusing almost entirely on encampments that they can declare obstructions and remove without any notice at all, except for a 30-minute verbal warning at the direction of Mayor Durkin. Barnett got confirmation of this from Seattle Police Sergeant Eric Zare, a team leader of the navigation team, who said, "I think the priority of the team has changed. The mayor wants us to focus on cleans that are more obstruction-oriented," end quote. Barnett cites a figure of 96% of encampments swept in April and May that were declared obstructions and swept with no notice to the occupants. Others have come up with a figure of over 86%, over 82%. So I think that's pretty good estimate. So, and so much for the ordinance passed by the city council that requires that 72-hour notice and at least two visits by outreach workers before a camp can be swept. Of course, that ordinance contained a loophole that the mayor and the navigation team have driven a semi-truck through. That loophole allows the navigation team to remove any encampment without notice that they consider to be in a dangerous place or that blocks sidewalks or streets or a public right-of-way. In other words, an obstruction. the navigation team and the mayor's office have interpreted that to mean any encampments that sit on any public land, including city parks, sidewalks, street corners, any encampment that appears on a patch of ground. And this is even more controversial, any encampment that appears on a patch of ground where a previous encampment was removed can automatically be, according to the city's interpretation, declared an obstruction and swept with no notice. Now, REACH will still be available to provide outreach services if the residents of a camp request it, or in the rare event when 72-hour notice is posted. But they're moving to a more neighborhood-based approach, trying to get to know the homeless population in each neighborhood to better identify their needs and work proactively to get them off the street before the navigation team gets to them, instead of just showing up 30 minutes before their stuff gets seized and thrown away, which of course is not helping anyone. In the meantime, the mayor's office is replacing REACH with two new hires for the navigation team, who are supposed to do the minimum amount of outreach required by law in that little 30-minute time window when the navigation team shows up and gives verbal notice that they're going to kick people off of a piece of property.
And this follows, I believe it was this year, the tail end of last year, when the mayor had significantly increased funding for the
navigation team. Yeah. So it is pretty clear that in spite of rhetoric that's coming out of the mayor's office, her policy is to just move people along without any meaningful offer of shelter or services. Even though the city continues to say, oh, we're housing people, we're doing more of it this year than last year and the year before, her actual policy and the actual emphasis of this mayor is to just sweep people and move them along and to harass them. It is not to provide meaningful services or shelter.
And this also appears to have been during this, at least in this recent increase in the last 2 months, appears to parallel the meetings that the mayor had with specific organizations from specific neighborhoods that were reacting
vocal about street crime. In other words, you know, finding dirty needles on the street or seeing icky homeless people camped in public places. Not necessarily an actual increase in street crime, but an increase in things that they just don't want to see in their neighborhood and that make them uncomfortable. So she appears to be responding and also, I think, responding to the concerns of businesses that, you know, it's the tourist season coming up. Seattle relies a lot on tourist dollars now, and we're a major tourist destination. And a lot of businesses, particularly in the downtown core and in some of Seattle's better known neighborhoods like Capitol Hill, for example, Ballard, around the Ballard Locks area, and other tourist destinations in the city, they really want a clean street and they want tourists to feel comfortable and able to go anywhere without feeling upset, needlessly upset by those icky homeless people. And that's her emphasis right now.
One of those neighborhoods, for instance, like Fremont, which one doesn't normally associate with the high crime or issues there.
And statistics show that crime has not increased in these neighborhoods. What has increased is the number of petty thefts. So people walking into businesses and taking things, shoplifting, in other words. And I have to say, when you take homeless people and you seize all their stuff with no notice and throw it all away, they need some of that stuff. And if that means then they're going to go into a nearby business and steal it, that's what they'll do. Of course, also when you don't offer drug treatment programs and meaningful shelter to folks, people who have a drug dependency need to finance it somehow. And they're going to resort to a lot of shoplifting and petty crime to do that. And that, I think, that the mayor's policies have really exacerbated the problem. They've not helped that problem of business losses related to shoplifting and petty crime.
All right. Moving on to different environmental
news developments this week? Of some environmental news this week here in the state of Washington. Governor Jay Inslee signed a package of state budget bills this week, and on Tuesday he directed the Department of Transportation, after signing a transportation budget bill, to move unspent funds for projects that are under budget into a new account. That money will be used to fix or replace highway culverts to allow better fish passage for salmon in the state of Washington. Now, the United States Supreme Court ruled last year that the state of Washington is required to spend the money to take down impassable culverts, some of which are too high, others have screens over them, and others are too narrow and the water rushes through them with too much force to allow fish to swim up them to reach rivers where they need to spawn. This year, the Washington State Legislature included about $100 million in the biannual budget for culvert replacement, but this project is likely to cost billions of dollars, and that $100 million was meant just to set up a plan for beginning the process. Inslee's decision will allocate another $175 million, of course, and that can be used to begin replacing the culverts, but of course, that's just a start. And he was very clear that this is just a, quote, one-time down payment, end quote, which means, of course, that next year the state legislature should look at it again before environmentalists, tribes, and recreational fishermen sue the state again to try to get them to put out the money to actually fix those culverts. Also this week, Governor Inslee declared a drought in almost half of Washington's counties. This winter, we had a lower-than-normal snowpack, followed by a warmer than normal spring. And the month of May has been much, much drier than usual, in spite of the little bit of rain that we're seeing today. Many of the water basins in central and western Washington are below 50% of their average snowpack. The upper Yakima Basin is actually at only 23% of its average snowpack level. And that spells a lot of trouble for eastern Washington farmers. For example, the apple crop, I think, in particular, is going to be in some danger this year. But, you know, it's not just farmers who struggle when we're under drought condition. Washington relies on hydroelectric power, especially the big cities in western Washington like Seattle and Tacoma and Bellevue. That's, of course, water flow over our dams. Often the dams compete with salmon and other fish that need water downstream for spawning. So salmon runs will suffer as well. And then there's the fire season. This year it's expected to be bad again, but probably worse than last year. And it could start earlier than last year. So if you remember last year, we essentially lost our best month of the summer, August, when everybody likes to be outside. We essentially lost it to smoky air because of the fires that surrounded us on all sides because of drought conditions last year. This year, we may lose both July and August if the fire season starts earlier. So I just want to send a little shout out to people who are out in the parks camping this weekend. Don't light a campfire, or if you do, make sure it is really out before you move on. And for heaven's sake, do not walk out into the bushes to have a cigarette.
Yeah, I'm guessing that the fire seasons are going to be expanding exponentially here, far more than just July, going well into September. And we've already had some fires.
Some fires already.
In eastern Washington. So,
yeah. Now, also this week, Washington's Democratic congressional delegation sent a letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo this week, asking him to intervene in a dispute with Canada over mining in the headwaters of the Skagit River. The headwaters of the Skagit River are in British Columbia. A Canadian company, Imperial Metals, wants to mine for copper and gold along the Smitherham Creek. Their operations would include exploratory drilling, trenching, and building settling ponds, which contain toxic metals and cyanide. When those ponds overflow or leak, the water flows downstream and kills aquatic wildlife. It's highly toxic. It's estimated that for every ounce of gold that's mined, 60 tons of toxic waste is produced. In 2014, not that long ago, just 5 years ago, a dam on a waste pond in British Columbia collapsed at the Mount Polly gold and copper mine that released 24 million cubic meters of toxic sludge into the Hazeltine Creek and Canal Lake. Canal Lake flows into the Fraser River. And the Fraser River is prime salmon habitat, perhaps the biggest and was the healthiest river for salmon runs in Canada. Now, the watery sludge contained lead, arsenic, nickel, zinc, cadmium, vanadium, antimony, manganese, and mercury, all metals that are toxic to fish and other aquatic wildlife, and it's highly recommended that people not drink that kind of water either.
I don't think there's any forms of life on this planet that benefit from those.
No, and you know, Canal Lake was previously considered the most pristine lake in British Columbia and a prime trout and salmon fishery in Western Canada. It is no longer. The Pauli mine breach is considered one of the worst environmental disasters, if not the worst environmental disaster in Canadian history. And that mine was also an Imperial Metals mine. Now, the Skagit River is Washington State's leading salmon river. Most of the headwaters are in BC are protected from development, except for a small portion along the Smitherim Creek, which is called the Donut Hole. That's where Imperial Metals wants to start mining. Now, the folks who signed the letter to Secretary of State Mike Pompeo include our two U.S. Senators, Maria Cantwell and Patty Murray, and our U.S. representative, our Democratic U.S. representatives in the House, Susan DelBonnet, Denny Heck, Pramila Jayapal, Derek Kilmer, Rick Larson, Kim Schreier, and Adam Smith. And a number of environmental groups, tribal leaders, and BC politicians have expressed their opposition to the plan to allow Imperial Metals to mine along the Smitherim Creek. Currently, the BC Ministry of Energy, Mines, and Petroleum Resources is reviewing the mining permit and could make a decision at any time. So I'm asking folks to also contact Mike Pompeo's office, saying that he should add his voice and the power of the U.S. federal government against that permit as well.
Well, you mentioned Jay Inslee, and I saw today that he had reached his...
He has reached the
65,000...
Yeah, the requirement, the required number of donors in order to make the first presidential debate. He will have a chance to talk about his key issue. I think it really points to the fact that voters are concerned about climate change, even though the Republican Party is in denial that climate change is real, even though many of the old guard members of the Democratic Party think it's a minor issue. Nancy Pelosi, I'm talking directly to you. Think it's a minor issue that they don't need to do anything about, or that it would be nice to do something about, but not necessary. There are a number of folks in the Democratic Party who believe that that should be the key or number one issue, and Inslee has gotten their support. And if he can make that a lead issue in the Democratic primaries, then all power to him, you know. It's an issue that he knows a lot about, and he can also point out too that I criticize him because he wasn't able to get a carbon tax passed or a cap and trade system passed in Washington State, but you know, there are a lot of other things you can do in addition to a carbon tax, or aside from a carbon tax or a cap and trade system. And we've done them in the state of Washington, and it's because Inslee didn't give up, and because the Democrats in our state legislature didn't give up.
Well, and it was primarily from people who, like
pushed
you
the
and
legislature.
I, who actually mm-hmm. went out. I mean, not that I actually went out, but you know, regular folks is my point.
Focus on these solutions, these other things that can be
done. They
go out
and protest day to day and do all the heavy lifting that elected officials come along and take credit for.
Who draft initiatives, who draft legislation, who get out in the streets, who lobby and push for these things.
And I think Inslee's message would carry a little more weight if he had, you know, had done a lot of things that he purports to do.
Like but he is coming to the discussion amongst the Democratic candidates with look what's occurred in my state.
Exactly. Look what the people of my state have actually done.
Yes, but he's also gotten behind that, which many Democrats have not done. I'm talking to you, Nancy Pelosi, again. You've not gotten behind the push of progressive Democrats and the people within the Democratic Party who want the Democratic Party at the highest levels to make climate change a top issue.
We can only hope.
Yes.
All right.
Last week I talked about the District 1 city council candidates. This week I want to just go over the District 2 city council candidates. District 2 is Bruce Harrell's seat. That's south and southeast Seattle from the SoDo and International District and the down through Beacon Hill, Rainier Valley to Georgetown, Columbia City, Othello, Seward Park, and Rainier Beach at the very south end, with the Duwamish River as the western boundary. That's its geographical location. It is highly diverse. It is the one district in the city of Seattle that is a majority people of color and minority white people. And the representative, Bruce Harrell, has not been, probably not been the most vocal of city council or even the most active of city council members on the council. He has been president this last year, but his presidency has been kind of laissez-faire, let's say. So let's take a look at who might replace him. He announced that he was not running for re-election. In the last election, he barely won with just a handful of votes over Tammy Morales. She is the lead candidate this year to run for his position. She ran in 2017 and nearly beat Bruce Harrell, the incumbent. And she has an extensive platform that includes more affordable housing, including more public housing, which is a very good idea. She has a lot of initiatives to deal with displacement, tenant protections, and a housing-first approach to homelessness, also a very good idea. She wants more affordable childcare for South Seattle residents, racial equity in South Seattle schools. I think a recent report showed that students of color are more often disciplined than white students in Seattle schools. And she wants more public health clinics in her district. She supports LGBTQ rights, a more progressive tax structure, and transitioning Seattle to clean energy. Her endorsements include U.S. Representative Pramila Jayapal, State Senator Rebecca Saldana, City Council Member Teresa Mosqueda, and Carrie Moon, who ran for mayor against Jenny Durkin. She's also been endorsed by a number of community activists, educators, and small business owners within her district. She has 75, as of the last public disclosure filing, she had $75,000 in contribution with over 51,500 of that in democracy vouchers. That's more than two-thirds of the donations she's collected, and about $350 of her own money. So she has a lot of support from people within her district. Now, the second candidate who has, I'm kind of taking them in order of how much money they've collected, is Ari Hoffman. He's a property manager. He's running under the slogan, quote, practical solutions for Seattle, end quote. He's a member of Speak Out Seattle and supports Safe Seattle. Those are two conservative groups that have made an issue of complaining at city council meetings and in other public forums about homeless people and street crime. He also gathered signatures for the initiative campaign to repeal the employee hours tax. So that shows you where he's coming from. His number one item on his platform is safety. And he asserts that Seattle is experiencing a crime wave of drug dealers and prostitutes, streets littered with used needles and icky homeless people. Again, he's definitely a member of that community that wants to make a big issue out of crime, even though crime has not increased in recent years. His solution is to enforce civility laws against panhandling, loitering, and vagrancy. And he completely supports the new Seattle Police Officers Guild contract, even though the federal court judge has rejected part of it as being unconstitutional and violating Seattle's police reform laws. He's also against safe injection sites and fully supports the encampment sweeps being done by the navigation team. His platform on homelessness supports Mayor Durkin's approach of defunding emergency shelters. He says that. Defunding emergency shelters and directing funds only to those organizations that support her law and order approach. He would like to set up big FEMA tents to replace the individual tents that many homeless folks currently have. He wants service providers to do background checks and deny services to anyone with a criminal record, even though I should point out that having a past criminal record is often the very reason why people are homeless and can't get a job and or can't take care of themselves. As for affordable housing, he wants the city to repeal as many regulations as possible, provide tax incentives, and upzone as much of the city as possible. In other words, give developers a free rein. He also thinks there are too many city council members and we should just cut the size of government. And those are all really typical Republican refrains. And he very clearly is the Republican in the race. He has $45,000 in contributions, including $500 of his own money. He's taken maximum contributions from a whole lot of real estate developers, real estate brokers and bankers. And he is not accepting democracy vouchers, so his contributors can give him a maximum of $500 each instead of the limit of $350 for candidates who are taking democracy vouchers. So he's clearly meant to be the person in the race that the real estate lobby can get behind, and that the business
Chamber of Commerce
folks can support. Yeah. Now there's some other good candidates in the race too who have collected a lot less money than Tammy Morales, who would be great. And one of them is Phyllis Porter. She's a former college instructor and a longtime neighborhood activist who's done work for Rainier Valley Greenways, Rainier Beach Economic Development Roundtable, Bike Works, Seattle Safe Routes to School, the Southeast District Council, and Vision Zero Rainier Valley. She was instrumental in getting the city to improve safety along Rainier Avenue South and Martin Luther King Jr. Way. When the city was not emphasizing the South End for street improvements. She has also worked with helping both men and women re-enter society after exiting prison, so she understands some of the struggles that homeless people have in the city of Seattle and ways to help them stay off the street. In addition to being a strong advocate for bicycling and improving Seattle's streetcars, she also supports locating affordable housing close to transit and light rail stations. She's for tenant protections, reducing evictions. She's for providing debt counseling and short-term rental assistance. She's for transportation and utility assistance to keep people in their homes, and legal support and job training services for folks reentering society after incarceration. She's collected $28,200 with $20,750, almost three quarters of her total coming from democracy vouchers. So I would love to see her and Tammy Morales make it through the primaries and square off in the final. We'll see how that goes. There are other good candidates too. Christopher Preguero is a manager of Seattle City Light's Environmental Equity Program. He started as an employee LGBTQ group within City Light. He's a volunteer at Camp Second Chance. That's one of Seattle's tiny house encampments for the homeless. And he'd like to see more of those camps set up, especially no-barrier camps that allow people who have drug addiction issues and mental health issues to get off the street. In Seattle, he would like to provide more services for drug and alcohol treatment, basic health care, and mental health services included with those camps. He has a three-pronged platform that includes economic equity for folks affected by poverty, discrimination, and most importantly, gentrification in his district, government transparency, and cultural accessibility, including respect for the multiple cultures and languages of people who live within District 2. In addition, his platform declares that housing is a human right and the city must end encampment sweeps and make good on the promise of building more affordable housing. He also supports diverting young people away from jail and to counseling and other programs, and he believes that restoring art, music, and athletic programs in South Seattle schools, as well as adding programs for science and tech training, coding, and entrepreneurial training would play an important role in keeping kids engaged and off the streets. He's against the new youth jail. He's for making transportation more affordable by reinstituting ride-free zones in downtown Seattle and expanding the city's voucher programs for lower-income people who need public transit access. He's raised $12,260. He's qualified for democracy vouchers but hasn't received any as of yet. but he would be another good person in this race. Also in this race is Mark Solomon. He was formerly a U.S. Air Force, formerly in the U.S. Air Force. He worked at the Defense Intelligence Agency in Washington, D.C., then as an intelligence analyst at McCord Air Force Base. He founded and ran a private security consulting firm, the Obsidian Security Group. He currently works as a crime prevention coordinator at the Seattle Police Department. He's a member of the 37th District Democrats and has served on the boards of many organizations, including Youth Care, HALO Transitional Housing, Washington Coalition of Crime Victim Advocates, and Aradia Women's Health Center, among many others. Of course, his number one issue is public safety, because that's his background, but he doesn't come from the knee-jerk, you know, support the Seattle Police Officers Guild contract at all costs angle that Ari Hoffman does. He supports common sense quality of life things like better street lighting and fewer pedestrian obstructions, filling potholes and fixing sidewalks in his district, and expanding public transit. He's also for prioritizing small businesses in his neighborhood over the large businesses that tend to come in after gentrification in Seattle neighborhoods. Regarding homelessness, he supports the movement to a regional approach, which is also one of Mayor Durkan's key platforms. But he wants the city to do more than just that. He wants to see rental assistance, building more affordable housing, increasing low to moderate barrier shelters, and more drug treatment and mental health programs. He also wants to expand some of the city's current services to keep elderly and disabled folks in their homes. He'd also like to see the city invest in more science and technology programs in South Seattle schools, as well as training in building and construction trades, and also, importantly, financial literacy. He'd like to invite high-tech companies to get involved in designing these programs to create a school-to-high-tech pipeline. I'm not sure where he stands on charter schools. I'm thinking he probably supports them. So he's a mixed candidate in this race. He does have support, when you look at his donors, from a lot of Democratic Party stalwarts. So he may get a lot of votes from the sort of mainstream pro-business wing of the Democratic Party. He's collected $10,884, including $390 of his own money. He has qualified for democracy vouchers, but hasn't received any as of yet. And there are two other candidates in the race who've raised no money so far. That's Henry Dennison, who's a Socialist Workers Party candidate, and Omari Tahir Garrett, who's a longtime Black rights activist whose most recent fight has been against the gentrification of the Central District. Now, Garrett is probably the most progressive candidate in the race, but he can also be something of a loose cannon. If you want to cast a protest vote in this race because you don't like any of the other candidates, they're not far enough left for you, he would definitely be that protest vote. And he would also definitely be a huge change from Bruce Harrell. But keep in mind that Garrett can be a little inconsistent when it comes to working with other people and getting behind good common sense compromise solutions. So that's the list of District 2 candidates. Of course, there are going to be some forums coming up, and we'll hear more from them about their platforms and what they support. So take a look at the list, hear what I've said, but do your own research and vote however you feel is the best.
Always, always, always do your own
research. Yes. Make up your own mind.
Yes. Go to multiple sources.
Mm-hmm.
All right.
Okay. National news.
Move on to national.
Yeah, this week the ACLU and Planned Parenthood filed a lawsuit against Alabama's abortion law. They filed suit in U.S. District Federal Court in Alabama to block Alabama's new law against all forms of abortion except when the mother's life is in danger, and it provides no provision for victims of rape or incest. The law would declare performing an abortion a felony, and doctors could be subject to sentences of up to 99 years in prison. Now, the ACLU and Planned Parenthood suit seeks to have the law declared unconstitutional and seeks to block the law from taking effect. This week, the governor of Missouri, Mike Parson, signed a bill into law that would prevent a woman from getting an abortion after the eighth week of pregnancy. Many women don't even know they're pregnant by the eighth week of their pregnancy. The Missouri law also makes no exception for women and children who've been raped or victims of incest. because Missouri has other restrictive abortion laws, like one that requires abortion providers to have admitting privileges with a nearby hospital, Missouri only has one abortion clinic left in the state, and that's in St. Louis. Other states, including Kentucky, Georgia, Ohio, and Mississippi, have passed fetal heartbeat bills that ban abortion as early as the sixth week of pregnancy. Again, women often don't know they're pregnant by the sixth week of pregnancy. The Mississippi law, fortunately, was blocked in court this week, late on Friday night, with a preliminary injunction that will prevent it from going into effect on July 1st while the lawsuit is working its way through the courts. On the other hand, in Vermont this week, the state legislature passed a bill to protect abortion rights. The bill prevents the government from interfering in any way in Vermont with the right for a woman to have an abortion. Meanwhile, in Utah, a federal judge blocked a bill to ban abortion after 18 weeks of pregnancy in another lawsuit that was brought by the ACLU and Planned Parenthood. In Michigan, Governor Gretchen Whitmer has said that she'll veto any abortion legislation, anti-abortion legislation, passed by the state legislature. So she's set to block any such bills passed in Michigan. And in Wisconsin, Governor Tony Evers announced that he would veto four anti-abortion bills that are currently making their way through the state legislature there if they reach his desk for signature. And I want to mention, too, this week that on Tuesday, protesters rallied in 400 cities and communities across the U.S. to protest bills banning or restricting abortion. From New York City to Atlanta, from Seattle to Los Angeles and everywhere in between, thousands of women and men were in the streets to protest access to these bills that ban access to abortion and to keep abortion safe and legal. And again, I want to point out, too, that this should be given the Democratic Party a sign of what issues are going to be most important as we go into the presidential primaries next year. Abortion is a key issue that we're going to want to hear how the different Democratic candidates for president stand on that issue.
Yeah. I think that could be a real driver in getting people, in the very least, both out to vote and out in the streets.
Yeah. And also, I want to point out, too, that groups like the ACLU and Planned Parenthood need your support in filing these lawsuits. Filing and pursuing these lawsuits are not cheap. So if you have the disposable income to make donations to organizations that are leading the fight in the federal courts against these anti-abortion bills, then I would urge you to support those organizations.
There's also numerous smaller organizations.
There are many small organizations taking up the legal fight. Yeah, so you should look into which groups are organizing demonstrations, which groups are lobbying state legislatures, which groups are pursuing the legal avenue to block these bills in court, and evaluate them and show them some financial support, because it costs money to do these things.
Yeah. There's an amazing infrastructure of different organizations and people doing work out there that we generally don't ever hear about or see until...
Yeah, as well as groups that provide family planning services to women. Those groups require financial support as well, especially in this era when the federal government is seeking to cut off funding to them.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope, let's move on.
Well, sticking with the concept of finances.
Yes, there was some news on Trump's finances this week. On Wednesday, the media reported that a leaked internal IRS memo concluded that the agency didn't have a good legal reason to withhold Donald Trump's tax returns from the House Ways and Means Committee. It was a draft legal memo written by Internal Revenue Service staff members. The memo says that the Treasury Secretary also doesn't have the authority to deny requests for tax returns made by a tax writing committee like the House Ways and Means Committee. Now, a spokesman for the IRS claimed that that draft memo was never finalized and sent to the IRS Commissioner Charles Rettig and never sent to Treasury Secretary Steven Mnuchin. And if that's the case, then I have to ask, why was that memo leaked to the media? It seems more likely that Rettig and Mnuchin didn't like the conclusion that IRS legal experts came to and just suppressed the memo. So, of course, the authors of the memo or their staff members decided to then leak it to the press. That would be my conclusion here. Now, on Wednesday, U.S. District Court Judge Edgardo Ramos ruled against Donald Trump's lawsuit to block Deutsche Bank and Capital One from furnishing documents to Congress. House Democrats are searching for evidence of money laundering on behalf of Russian individuals and companies that Trump has done business with in the past, Russian and perhaps also Saudi Arabian folks, you know. Of course, Trump's lawyers immediately filed an appeal to that decision by Judge Ramos. This came after the New York Times printed an article this week in which Deutsche Bank anti-money laundering specialists said that they had flagged suspicious activities in both Donald Trump's and Jared Kushner's accounts and were getting ready to file reports to the Treasury Department to report that suspicious activity, but that their managers told them not to report the activity so as not to alienate a large and lucrative client, and that that was standard Deutsche Bank procedure. Some of those Deutsche Bank specialists are set to testify to Congress as soon as the lawsuit that Donald Trump and his companies has filed to block Deutsche Bank from releasing information to Congress is settled. Now, this also came 2 days after U.S. District Court Judge Amit Mehta in Washington, D.C., ruled against Donald Trump's attempt to block his accounting firm, Mazars USA, from surrendering documents to Congress. Mazars performed accounting for the Trump Organization, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, and Donald Trump's personal finances. Now, the Donald J. Trump Foundation, I should point out, too, was recently dissolved under New York State Court supervision after the New York Attorney General uncovered, quote, a shocking pattern of illegality, end quote, in how its funds were used, including funds spent to bolster Donald Trump's presidential campaign, which, by the way, is not and has never been an approved charity. And also this week, Trump lost again in New York when the state legislature passed a bill that would allow Congress, the U.S. Congress, to obtain Donald Trump's New York State tax returns from the New York State Department of Taxation and Finance. His state returns contain a lot of the same information as his federal tax returns, so that may be the first piece of his finances that will be made public and sent to Congress. I should also point out Trump lost again in court this week. This is not related to his finances, but related to how he handles the U.S. taxpayer money. A federal judge, Judge Haywood Gilliam of the U.S. District Court in Northern California, issued an injunction against Trump's effort to divert funds from from the Department of Defense and the U.S. Treasury to build his wall along the southern border with Mexico. Judge Gilliam said that he cannot circumvent Congress's power of the purse in order to spend money wherever he wants to on whatever projects he wants to. He did that with his private foundation, trying to spend charitable funds on his presidential campaign, but he cannot do it with U.S. taxpayer money, according to Judge Gilliam.
Well.
So, looking good for Congress and looking not so good for the president in this fight over who gets to do what with federal money.
All right. Anything else on that?
Nope. Let's move on.
All right. Also this week, Julian Assange.
Yeah. Julian Assange, who is currently in police detention in Britain, was charged with 17 counts of conspiracy to obtain and disseminate secret government documents, espionage, and one count of conspiring to hack a government computer. The government of Ecuador revoked Assange's asylum in early April. Many would say illegally, since Ecuador had granted him citizenship. But as soon as they kicked him out of the Ecuadorian embassy in London, British police picked him up and arrested him. Early this week, a Swedish prosecutor filed a request to have Assange extradited to Sweden to stand trial for an old rape case. That was the reason that Assange took refuge in the Ecuadorian embassy in the first place. Assange had assiduously fought that case in both the Swedish and British legal systems, and having lost at every turn, took refuge in the only embassy that would take him. That was the Ecuadorian embassy. Now, in British now I want to point out, too, in British legal history, there has been no precedent for the British government to extradite a person for espionage, and this doesn't comport with international law. But the Swedish prosecutor, on the other hand, has a very strong case for extradition, and that's the one that probably will eventually prevail. What really concerns me about the U.S. indictment, though, is that the Trump administration is trying to prosecute Assange for espionage because he did something that so many media outlets and journalists do as a matter of their business. He spoke with a government whistleblower, in this case, Chelsea Manning, and he published portions of leaked government documents, similar to what the New York Times did with the Pentagon Papers, and that the U.S. Supreme Court had decided in favor of the New York Times that that was protected speech under the First Amendment. The Trump administration is clearly trying to narrow the definition of free speech under the First Amendment to crack down on the investigative powers of the press and to strike fear into the hearts of all current and former employees who want to badmouth their bosses or leak government documents that they realize are either a violation of the law or prove that the government is lying to the U.S. people about its policies. Now, it's worth noting that the Obama administration Department of Justice considered filing espionage charges against Assange, but they never went through with it for First Amendment reasons because they realized that it would not be allowed or should not be allowed under the First Amendment. But Donald Trump's attorney general, on the other hand, could care less, obviously, about First Amendment protections.
And so we're seeing numerous media outlets currently that had nothing, at least during the last year or so, has had nothing good to say about Julian Assange, all of a sudden getting
behind him. Yeah, alarmed
at this particular aspect because they see that the target is actually moving in front of them.
Yeah.
They can see the little red dot.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see what Congress does in this case, too, if any members of Congress say, hey, we can't allow this to go forward, or whether they're all going to line up and say, hey, Assange, you know, printed those leaked Democratic Party emails and we don't support him. So we're not going to speak out against this clear violation of the First Amendment by the Trump Department of Justice. But I think it's very important to separate the person, Julian Assange, from the process that the U.S., that Donald Trump's Department of Justice is trying to go through in order to expand executive powers and clamp down on what is a key cornerstone of the U.S. political process, which is the Bill of Rights here. Are the Democrats going to line up behind the Bill of Rights, or are they going to just say, hey, go after Julian Assange no matter what it takes? It'll be interesting to see what happens there.
All right. Moving on to international, and appears again, sticking with Donald Trump. He's trying to scooch some more
money to his foreign friends. Yeah.
Yeah. Some more weapons, too.
Yeah. This week, Mike Pompeo sent letters to Congress saying that President Donald Trump will use his emergency powers to finalize 22 arms deals with Saudi Arabia, the United Arab Emirates, and Jordan, supposedly to deter Iran. This is part of the Trump administration trying to drum up an emergency over Iran when it's not clear to anyone that anything has changed in the Middle East in terms of Iran. Pompeo provided no information about what could have triggered this emergency declaration or why the deals had to be finalized immediately. The deals include $8.1 billion worth of missiles, bombs, drones, aircraft parts, repair and maintenance services, automatic rifles, among other weapons and paraphernalia. In early April, both houses of Congress voted to end support for Saudi Arabia's aerial bombing campaign of its neighbor, Yemen, because of the humanitarian crisis in Yemen and the high number of Yemeni civilians who have been killed in those aerial bombing raids. And we've seen that continue right up and through the past week. Trump vetoed that bill, and Republicans in Congress have not stepped up to say that they will override his veto. Congress then delayed finalizing weapons sales to Saudi Arabia, and its ally, the United Arab Emirates. These large weapon sales to foreign nations have to be approved by Congress. Those deals can be cut by the president, by the Pentagon, by weapons contractors, but they have to be reviewed and approved by Congress, and Congress has delayed finalizing those sales. Now Trump is doing an end run around Congress's ability to oversee where money is spent and where weapons are sent by the U.S. government in order to ensure that Donald Trump's business partners in Saudi Arabia can continue their war. There is no new crisis with Iran that these weapons are meant to address. For example, one of these deals provides help with manufacturing F-18 aircraft in Saudi Arabia, but the Saudi Arabian Air Force does not use F-18s in their Air Force. They do not use those. Instead, those F-18s will then be turned around and sold by the Saudi Arabian government to other countries for a profit. Some of their biggest customers for F-18s are countries like South Korea and India, and also Israel. So it's not clear. It's not clear that these weapons are going to be used in any way to defend Iran's neighbors from any kind of Iranian aggression. It looks simply like it's just more pork for Donald Trump to give to his friends in Saudi Arabia, his business partners. And I want to point out, too, that during his presidential campaign, Donald Trump often bragged about the great deals that he had done with Saudi Arabian individuals and businesses. He called them some of his best customers. And he is clearly sending a lot of pork their way now.
Further greasing the skids.
Yeah.
All right. Events.
Yeah. Several events this week. This weekend is the Folklife Festival at Seattle Center. A lot of local bands will be there. There'll be a lot of great events there. That started yesterday. And it runs through Monday, which is Memorial Day. So check it out at least one day this weekend.
And it's free compared to the bumper shoot, which is
free.
Usually pricey.
And often at Folklife, you'll see groups there who are gathering signatures for political initiatives. There's expected to be a table where you can register to vote. There are other great organizations that you may see there at Folklife. The Seattle International Film Festival is also currently running through June 9th at various locations around town. You can check out their great list of documentary films and internet films from foreign countries at www.sif.net.
And they're always great because after the films, they usually have people who put the film together there to talk to the audience.
Especially their weekend films, the ones before 9 p.m., they often have the director there, or they will have other people who have worked on the film talking about their motivation for making the film and telling great stories about how the film was put together.
So that's a great,
and sometimes talking about the issues addressed in the films as well. So that's a great resource and definitely check it out. Also on Tuesday, there are a number of candidate forums coming up this week. On Tuesday, District 2 is the District 2 candidate forum on transportation, housing, and sustainability. That will be from 6 p.m. to 7:30 p.m. at New Holly Gathering Hall. That's at 7054 32nd Avenue South. Check that out. The candidates will have the ability to address these various issues and other questions there. That's a great way to evaluate who you want to vote for. Also on Tuesday, May 28th, Annie Jacobson will talk about her new book, Surprise, Kill, Vanish, The Secret History of CIA Paramilitary Armies, Operators, and Assassins. That's at 7:30 to 9 p.m. at Town Hall, 1119 8th Avenue at Seneca Street. And I should mention that
the newly renovated
Town Hall is fully opening up this week too. Now, on Wednesday, May 29th, is the District 7 candidate forum. I will be going to that. On transportation, housing, and sustainability. That's from 6 to 8 p.m. at the SEIU headquarters at 215 Columbia Street in downtown Seattle. On Thursday, May 30th, is the District 4 candidate forum. That's from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. at the Cascade Bicycle Club. That's District 4 is the University District and other parts of Northeast Seattle. That's going to be at 7787 62nd Avenue Northeast from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. on Thursday. Then on Saturday, June 1st, is Lilo's 2019 dinner in honor of Silmi Domingo, Jean Viernes, and Milton Jefferson. Lilo stands for Legacy of Equality, Leadership, and Organizing. They were founded in the early 1970s to empower low-income workers of color, immigrants, and women to organize for their rights. This is their annual fundraising dinner. Tickets are $80. It's from 5:30 to 9:30 at the Filipino Community of Seattle, 5740 Martin Luther King Way, King Jr. Way South. You can purchase tickets at squareup.com. And then Sunday, June 2nd is the National Animal Rights Day in Seattle with music, speakers, and lots of local organizations who will be tabling at that event. This is an international event held every year on the first Sunday in June to honor our allies of a different species. That's at noon at Westlake Park, 4th Avenue and Pine Street downtown.
A lot of animals going to be
Sunday.
There speaking. And
there will be people there to
doing
speak,
a sing-along.
To speak for them, but there may be some animals there as well.
Right.
Yeah. So that wraps up our show. I just want to say that if you enjoy our show and it's a mainstay of your week, please go online and show your support for us at our website, kodxseattle.org. There's a Patreon button where you can make a sustaining contribution, or you can send us a one-time donation via check. Make your check out to Earth on the Air Independent Media and mail it to
P.O. Box 45883, Seattle, Washington, 98145. You can find that info on the website as well. And also for
KODXseattle.org.
That too. And also want to remind you that we do broadcast during the weekdays, during the rest of the week, Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. So check it out.